Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And this, Anthony, is episode 15. And today we're going to talk about phosphorus with Lindsay Peace. And so I'm just going to let Lindsay introduce herself and then kind of share experience she had with phosphorus and algae. And this is kind of going to shape our discussion over the next four episodes. So,
wow, four episodes on phosphorus.
Yes, it's a big topic, Anthony. So, Lindsay Peace.
Yeah, my name is Lindsay Peace. I am an assistant professor and extension specialist in nutrient and water management at the Research and Outreach Center for the University of Minnesota. I started studying phosphorus when I was working on my PhD, and I was working with USDA ARS there and Norm Fauzi, and he had a lot of drainage sites that were in the Western Lake Erie Basin. And at that time, we were both looking at nitrogen and phosphorus in the drainage system. But, you know, it's actually 2014. I was working on my dissertation when the Toledo water crisis happened. I grew up in Western Lake Erie Basin. I grew up in the city in a suburb of Toledo, and my parents still lived there, and they actually got a phone call at 5 a.m. telling them that the water wasn't safe. It's a wild story. I mean, and I think people really take for granted that their water is going to come out the tap and it's going to be safe. And yeah, when you get that literal wake-up call, it was pretty shocking. And then phosphorus really just entered the public eye, I guess you would say, as far as a potential water quality problem.
So, Toledo water crisis, you're familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah. So, I didn't know Toledo had suburbs. I just can't believe that, but I guess so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Brookings, right?
Right.
Brookings, the suburbs of Volga and Aurora. No one other than people from South Dakota will get
right.
That's a joke.
Right, but yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, Toledo water crisis, 3 days without drinking water, and really uncertain about what the future held as far as when they would get water.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. And how dangerous is it? You know, yeah. I know you start thinking about that.
Right. And so that's really kind of what we're going to jump off on, of why phosphorus is drinking water and water quality issue. It's not because of the phosphorus itself, but it's because phosphorus is a limiting nutrient for algae typically in freshwater systems. And so once phosphorus gets into the system, then that algae, it has everything it needs. Once it gets the phosphorus, yep. It can take off.
It's an instigator.
It's a catalyst, not a good catalyst. And so then, so indirectly.
Well, the algae think it's good.
This is true. The algae are having a great time. So the other reason we think about phosphorus is because it's one of the three macronutrients.
Plant essential nutrient.
Yeah, plant essential nutrient. So critical for life. Critical for human life, plant life, algal life.
ATP, yeah, adenosine triphosphate.
Yeah, man, that's like, I remember that from biology.
Oh, yeah, botany, you bet.
That's probably the last time I saw that was in high school.
The Krebs cycle.
Oh, man. Digging back in my...
I'm an agronomist.
Yeah, this is true, yeah.
Okay.
So, and then a local example here is Lake Mitchell, and we'll talk more about Lake Mitchell later in the episode, whenever we talk about concentrations, but I guess just to bring home that it's not just a Lake Erie issue.
Right.
It's
an everybody issue.
It's an everybody issue. Almost mm-hmm. any freshwater system in the U.S. Well, I don't know, maybe that's a broad statement, but a lot of freshwater systems in the U.S. from farm ponds to Lake Erie, you know, the Great Lakes.
Correct. I noticed the Big Sioux had algae in it.
Sure enough, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're in a drought right now. Mm-hmm. And so there's less volume. The phosphorus doesn't go away. So as your volume decreases, that phosphorus can concentrate and problems.
Yeah, you get an algae bloom.
Yeah.
It might not be the wrong algae, right?
Right.
There's different kinds.
Yeah. And so there is a differentiation between, I guess, nuisance algae and then cyanotoxins. So the algae that actually produces the toxins.
Yeah, we don't want to lead anybody to believe that there's a big problem there. But
yeah,
just was commenting.
Yeah, just the presence of algae does not indicate harmful algal blooms. And really, although it's challenging because you have to kind of look at it under a microscope or, you know, do some actual right. lab tests to determine if it's, and actually usually it's whether it's producing the toxins or not is how you determine if it's a harmful algal bloom or not. Yep. But anyway, let's go back to Lindsay, hear the full story of the Toledo water crisis, and then we'll dig into phosphorus and tile drainage, and then kind of some of the nuance there related to surface runoff and subsurface drainage. And then from there, we'll go on to kind of why phosphorus is such a challenging issue. So Toledo water crisis from Dr. Lindsay Peace.
You know, something that's really interesting about what happened is that I think prior to the water issues that we saw in Western Lake Erie Basin, there was another lake in Northwest Ohio that had phosphorus problems, and that was called Grand Lake St. Mary's. And that one had such a bad algal bloom that, you know, dogs were getting sick. I think somebody's dog actually died due to the toxic levels. And that was a bit of a different situation because that was all within one county. It was the most animal production that was happening really in that part of the state. And it was a man-made lake. So it had all these problems. It didn't have any like natural outlet for the phosphorus to leave. And a lot of people were disposing of manure on their fields. And so you're creating a legacy phosphorus problem, which means, you know, you're applying more and more phosphorus onto the land. It's getting built up and built up. And it's way past the rate where it would be of benefit to your crops. But that's really was how they needed to dispose of the manure. So, you know, it's a problem, right? You need to get rid of the waste somehow. But yeah, that algal bloom kind of happened first. And people really rallied around that and were like, okay, this is what we need to do. We need to find different ways of disposing of the manure and lower those phosphorus levels. So I think in some ways, the, you know, and other people, other farmers from other parts of the state kind of had seen that process happen. So when algal blooms were happening in Lake Erie, I think the farmers were maybe not that surprised. And I think as a research community, you know, we'd seen a very large algal bloom in 2011. So we knew that had been the biggest bloom on record up to that point. So I think the agricultural community and the research community had an idea that water quality was becoming an issue in Western Lake Erie Basin, but the people that drank the water, they had no idea. They had no idea that this problem was looming. They had started testing for the cyanobacteria toxin, and it had, you know, sort of been close to the level before, but hadn't really triggered a shutdown. What was different about 2014 was I think the wind patterns were keeping that bloom sort of concentrated around the water intake. So even though it wasn't as big of a bloom, it was more toxic. And actually, there hasn't been like a big water advisory like that happened since. And they've also upgraded the water treatment plant to be able to take out the toxin if it gets high. So they've got, you know, more infrastructure invested. And yeah, and then in those 3 days, you know, they were just really had to wait for those levels to come back down. There was no treatment capacity, you know, for that at the time. And I think that was what was really upsetting for people is, you know, not only did they know their water wasn't safe, they really had no idea when their water would be back and when it'd be safe to drink again. I mean, so yeah, it was only 3 days, but those were a very stressful 3 days for everybody.
So what do you think, Anthony?
She explains that well. I don't like using the word disposing of manure. I sure. just, you know, I do some education on that topic, and we have to change that mindset. Those nutrients in manure are very valuable.
Yeah, I think this is such a big discussion. I think it could take up a whole nother episode.
Oh, yeah, we could go a long ways on that one.
But briefly, kind of what are you thinking on that? So disposal versus what?
Well, it's a commodity. It's not a waste anymore.
Sure.
We shouldn't look at it as a waste.
Yeah. Now, an environmentalist would say if we change the language, we're just greenwashing the practice.
Well, we have to change the perception of what manure is.
Okay.
Then people will treat it differently. If we show them it has value and they should treat it like a commodity, then hopefully they will start doing that.
Right. And really, I mean, if we think about manure from a water quality perspective, there's a few things if we misapply it or overapply it that we worry about. One of them is, of course, bacteria and E. coli and things like that. But the other big one is nutrients.
Correct.
And then there's no difference really in application of synthetic fertilizer and manure.
No difference at all.
It comes down to nutrient content and matching that with what the plant needs.
Absolutely.
So I want to touch briefly on nutrients in general. The biggest ones we think about from a water quality perspective are nitrogen, specifically nitrate. That could be a whole nother episode too of kind of the nuance between nitrate, ammonia, ammonium, nitrite, like the differentiation of compounds, nitrogen compounds, and kind of why there are issues and things like that.
Right.
But typically, when we think about water quality, we compare nitrate and phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a good comparison. Chad's going to talk about this more in a few minutes, but Lindsay differentiates these pretty well. We'll get her take on this, kind of the breakdown of phosphorus and nitrogen and where they're considered issues, freshwater, seawater, that type of thing.
Right.
Phosphorus, it actually causes a similar problem to nitrogen in that it is a driver of harmful algal blooms. But the difference between algal blooms in freshwater and algal blooms in seawater is really just how the algae is processing the nutrients. So in saltwater, nitrogen is the limiting nutrient. So that's why in like all of the Mississippi River Basin, everybody's focused on nitrogen because that's the limiting nutrient. But for freshwater systems, you know, like Lake Erie, Lake Winnipeg, and well, lots of other lakes, Lake Superior even, phosphorus becomes the limiting nutrient for the algae. So you want to be lowering your phosphorus inputs into lake systems.
So again, phosphorus, limiting nutrient, freshwater systems. And in some ways, I don't know, it is challenging to treat phosphorus because once it's in the system, it doesn't cycle out. Nitrogen has a way to cycle out of the system.
Right, it transforms where phosphorus doesn't.
Yeah. And so since this is a conservation drainage season, we're going to tie everything back to tile drainage and kind of see, you know, how tile drainage affects phosphorus loss, affects these systems. And historically, the common understanding, and this is still true, I shouldn't say that the science has changed, we just know more now, but historically, we've only seen phosphorus as a sediment problem.
Right.
Phosphorus sticks to sediment.
Mm-hmm. It's on our soil.
And so it can build up in the soil. It stays in the soil. And so if you reduce erosion, you reduce
phosphorus movement.
Phosphorus movement. And so if we look at tile drainage, we typically have less surface runoff because more of the water is leaving the system, infiltrating. Yep. You have more soil capacity there. And so conventionally we've looked at phosphorus loss and tile drainage and seen it as a way to reduce erosion and then reduce phosphorus loss.
Correct.
And that's true for total phosphorus. But more recently, and then when we started digging into, I mean the broader scientific community. I had no part in this, of course. but so the broader scientific community started digging into phosphorus in Lake Erie and some of these, you know, freshwater watersheds.
Right. Correct. Yep.
And we see that there is actually, you know, a little bit maybe of dissolved reactive phosphorus or the phosphorus that's in the water that comes out of tile drainage or otherwise. And it just takes a little bit to
make a problem.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to let Lindsay talk through kind of the relationship between tile and phosphorus, and then we'll discuss that.
I think that tile drainage definitely does contribute to phosphorus losses. And this was especially true where I was in Ohio. There's a little bit of a different, like how the water goes through the system is a little bit different in Ohio versus in kind of the Northern Great Plains where we are now. And it really just has to do a little bit more with the timing of when the tiles are flowing. Really in Ohio, what you would see is that there are low levels of phosphorus loss, but those tiles, they drain almost all year long. the ground doesn't freeze. So even in January, you're still getting tile flow through those gravity outlets. And so you get a really slow drip of phosphorus out of the tile lines, you know, day after day. And over a whole year, that adds up to be actually a bigger contribution to phosphorus loss than what you're losing in the surface runoff. But that's for drained fields, you know, and I still think that drainage can reduce phosphorus losses due to runoff. So there is a bit of a trade-off. You're reducing your runoff, you know, but you are kind of trading it for more tile flow. But then what we start to see as you move further north is that, you know, the tile flow really is happening primarily just during the growing season, except this winter is a little bit warm. So so it's definitely going to depend on just what the weather is like. So, you know, if we don't get the ground to freeze up, you know, you still be losing a little bit every day. But for the most part, there's a good period of time in the northern Great Plains where the tiles aren't flowing. So they're going to be less of a contribution probably further north that you get.
Yeah, you know, the climate really impacts that as well. We're seeing that, those differences. Yeah.
And so, yeah, things are going to change too as we see different climate patterns in different parts of the country. And so this past winter, so December 2020, January 2021, we were actually collecting tile samples during those winter months in South Dakota.
Yeah, yep.
And so if we get into situations like that, then yeah, it is, you know, maybe 12, maybe 10, maybe 11 months a year that we're getting some loading out of the system, some flow.
Yep.
So whereas historically, you know, maybe it's 9 months of the year, maybe it's 8, you know, like it's.
Well, we typically have less precipitation too. So
that's true.
You know, we don't need to take water out all year long.
Right. So I think too, if we think about water movement through the system, as we get more, there's potential for more loss. I mean, it's just more flux, more potential for loss.
And we have that variability in our precipitation too.
Yeah.
The average isn't what we get. It's either high or it's low.
Yeah. Which creates all kinds of challenges.
Right. It's not consistent.
So Lindsay talked about kind of the constant drip or steady drip potential, steady loss potential of phosphorus through tile. But I don't want to give the misconception of when we look at the total picture. So I'll let her give the big picture perspective relationship between tile drainage and phosphorus loss.
From a big picture perspective, I actually would say that tile drainage reduces phosphorus loss because those surface runoff events can be really impactful in a way of, you know, releasing a lot of sediment and a lot of water from the ground surface. And at least if it's filtering through the soil profile, it has a chance for some of that to filter out. It obviously doesn't filter out everything. And we do have preferential flow pathways. So some of that water is going to short circuit and basically act like surface runoff, even though it's coming through the tile. But I think overall, what you're doing with tile drainage is you're creating space for water to kind of infiltrate into the soil profile. And that's really beneficial for preventing some surface runoff events.
So I don't think anybody that tells you one way or the other is 100% correct. And there's nuance to this issue, right? So total phosphorus loss generally decreases with tile drainage.
Correct.
Because you're reducing that
erosion potential,
But soluble phosphorus has the potential to maybe increase with tile drainage because there's a pathway for it to leave the system.
And I suppose that's really controlled by the amount of phosphorus in the soil itself.
Yes. And I would defer to you on that because that's your expertise. But yeah, I think the more and more it builds up, the more potential there is for that equilibrium to shift toward pushing phosphorus into the water, out of the soil. And then when that happens, now it has the potential to leach and to leave.
To move into the tile water.
So we're going to bring in Dr. Chad Penn, and I'll let him introduce himself and then give my personal history with Chad. He's a great guy.
My name's Chad Penn. I'm a soil scientist, a soil chemist for the USDA Agriculture Research Service, located at the National Soil Erosion Lab in West Lafayette. On campus at Purdue. I'm also an adjunct professor in the Department of Agronomy.
So Chad is actually, he was my soil chemistry teacher, professor whenever I was Oklahoma State. And I mean, like he's great at a lot of stuff, but I think of him most for phosphorus.
Phosphorus is his thing.
And,
yeah.
And phosphorus removal structures. But one of the other challenges related to phosphorus is the levels that we typically see are very low when we compare that to nitrate. And
PPBs.
Yeah, right. It's in the parts per billion range rather than the parts per million range. So it's, you know, 10 to 100 to 1,000 times less than what we see for nitrate.
Right.
And if you're used to looking at nitrate numbers, you're like, oh, you're thinking you're golden, right?
Right.
Because it's so low. Like it almost seems inconsequential.
Non-existent.
Non-existent. But I'm going to let Chad tell a story about kind of why this is not the case, and then we'll discuss that too.
I remember one time, you know, our nitrogen expert at Oklahoma State, somebody from the USDA, and she was talking about nitrogen and phosphorus losses, and they do a lot of monitoring at that station, as you know. And of course, she's presenting concentrations of phosphorus. I remember, the nitrogen expert, you know, raises a hand at the end, and he says, so it's only, you know, it's less than 0.1 milligrams per liter. What's the big deal? Why can't we just turn our heads? I mean, and he meant it, you know, he really meant it. And she didn't have a good answer, you know, but the answer is phosphorus and nitrogen are different. Their dynamics in the soil is totally different. And it takes different concentrations to cause environmental problems. And it just so happens that phosphorus, you only need a tiny bit of it to cause an algal bloom. And the problem is we need a lot of it to grow crops. And if we lose a tiny bit of it, and most of what we apply stays in the soil, you know, it's very, very high, much more efficient in that regard compared to nitrogen. You know, it generally stays put, but that tiny fraction that's leaving is causing algal blooms. And I think that was partly the disconnect. You know, some people will treat it as if like scientists of several decades ago were ignorant to phosphorus. Oh, they were so stupid. They didn't understand that phosphorus was soluble moving. No, they absolutely understood it. You go read those papers and those guys, they understood it better than we do now. Okay. I'm very confident of that. They understood it in great detail how it worked. What they didn't know was that little bit of phosphorus that was leaving was going to be detrimental to an aquatic system.
Phosphorus chemistry.
And so I was actually looking up this recently, and there were some kind of groundbreaking landmark studies or reviews that tried to look at what is causing algal blooms. Is it carbon? Is it nitrogen? Is it phosphorus? And so prior to that, again, if you're looking at losses from a field, you can measure the losses, you can see the losses, and if you compare it to, you know, if you compare phosphorus to nitrogen, then it's inconsequential.
Very small.
Very small. And before we knew that, you know, phosphorus was a limiting nutrient, then it doesn't seem like it's an issue. But now we know that, it only takes a little bit to make a big difference.
Same thing in our soils, too. I mean, that's why it's NP, you know.
Sure.
Phosphorus is a lot less than nitrogen.
Sure. So to me, that's one of the challenges from a, education perspective of, hey, yeah, we're not losing much phosphorus off a landscape.
But we don't need to. Just a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's hard from an education perspective. It's also hard from a treatment perspective. Because it's hard to also justify treating something that you're just trickling out. I mean,
right.
it's like put in a giant filter for an eyedropper type thing.
Yeah.
So that's one of the challenges to me. And then the other challenge, or another challenge, we're going to get to two more, but another challenge is, again, the fact that phosphorus doesn't cycle out of the system. I asked Lindsay about this, and she really dug into this, kind of the chemical and physical properties that just don't allow phosphorus to leave the system. They just kind of cycle within the system.
You've got some phosphorus that is attached to sediment, and, you know, erosion can be a really big issue in a lot of these watersheds too. So you have phosphorus that's dissolved in the water. Some of it is, and that's readily available for uptake by the algae. But then you have other sediment that's slower to release. So, you know, the phosphorus might be bound pretty tightly to the soil when it enters the stream, but then over time it can release. So you see release of phosphorus from lake bed sediments, and it's really all a chemistry-based process for the most part, you know, really dominated by those chemical interactions. So changes in pH and changes in concentration gradients, all of those things are going to let the sediment release phosphorus over time. And then, so, you know, even what might be in the lake today might not be the same as what's in the lake in a week or in a month or a year. People that study nitrogen say they like nitrogen better because it moves a lot more. I kind of like studying phosphorus because it doesn't move. There's a fewer pathways for it to move, but I mean, but that's really true. Once you end up with high levels of phosphorus in a system, it really takes a long time for that to cycle out naturally. So that's kind of where we start to see like really kind of long-term impacts of phosphorus detriment on water bodies.
So that's challenge number two to me. Once it's there, it's there.
It's there, right.
And so I want to talk about Lake Mitchell. We mentioned that at the beginning of the episode a little bit, and I want to talk about Lake Mitchell a little more right now. Lake Mitchell, near Mitchell, South Dakota, of course, home of the world's only corn palace.
Right.
And
so it's a man-made lake.
It is a man-made lake, and one of the biggest challenges with it is the ratio of the drainage area to the actual lake area. I think it's like 500-1 or something. I don't know. My numbers could be off there, but it's a really big drainage area going into a relatively small lake.
So we're concentrating a lot of stuff there.
Right. And so even if our upland practices and landscape was pristine, you're still concentrating lots of nutrients and sediment in that small volume of water, again, relatively. So that's a challenge for Lake Mitchell. But when it comes to phosphorus, and then going back to this comparison of concentrations, the concentration of phosphorus in the water, it varies, but let's say between 0.6 and 0.8 parts per million.
Okay.
So again, compare that to nitrate, the nitrate drinking water standard of 10 parts per million. Well, shoot, we're over 10 times lower than that standard, that benchmark.
Yep.
But for there not to be algal issues in Lake Mitchell, we need to be 0.06 to 0.08. So 10 times lower than what it is now. So 100 times lower, over 100 times lower than the drinking water standard for nitrate.
Right.
So that's challenge number one. Challenge number two, if you look at the loading, so where the phosphorus is coming from that's present in the water column, around 47%, 45 to 47 of the loading of phosphorus in Lake Mitchell is internal.
It's right there already.
So that means, yeah, it's being released from sediment. It's being released from organic matter, algae that's decaying, whatever the case would be. And it just cycles back up into the water column.
And that kind of usually happens when that water overturns in the lake?
So it's partly that. Like, so part of it is a resuspension of sediment, but part of it's a gradient thing. As there's less phosphorus in the water, then phosphorus from the sediment will move into the water. And part of it's a chemical reaction thing, as pH and things like that change, it'll be released. But yeah, I mean, there's really no way to prevent it. I shouldn't say there's no way to prevent it, but it's challenging to prevent it. One thing you can do is try to cap it with alum. And so that basically—
Seal it.
Yeah, basically seal it, flocculate that sediment and settle it to the bottom and kind of seal over the top of that.
Lock it in a way. Yeah.
Right, yeah, lock it in. But it's temporary, it's expensive, it's challenging. Another way you can look at it is dredging it, so actually removing the sediment. But man, that's a huge undertaking.
Oh, big deals. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's the, I'd say, second challenge, big challenge with phosphorus, and from a local example. And then I'm going to let Chad talk about the third, what I view as the third challenge, and that's kind of the variability of phosphorus loss.
I mean, it can change within an event within a matter of minutes to hours. We do a lot of monitoring up in northern Indiana and particularly in the Western Basin. And you'll see, you know, concentrations of 0.1 milligrams per liter dissolved pee coming through a towel. And then 30 minutes later, it's 1 milligram per liter. And then as the event subsides, it'll drop back down. So I guess the short answer is within an event, it partly depends on how fast the water is moving through your system. Mark Williams and I work a lot together on Mark being a hydrologist. That's the sort of thing we're trying to get at now is trying to understand the nature of dissolved P loss. And what we're finding is that the hydrology and the soil chemistry are dynamic. So the hydrology will partly control the ability of the soil to serve as a sink for phosphorus and how it will behave as a source of phosphorus and how it can change.
So it's variable.
Yeah. So that makes it harder to treat.
Yeah. If you have an inconsistent low concentration.
Right.
Yeah.
And then a high concentration.
You got to be ready for the big one.
And then also the fact that soil can act as either a sink, so phosphorus can go from the water into the soil, or it can act as a source. That depends on the concentration of phosphorus in the water and that gradient kind of between the water and the soil. And then it
and
also
the chemistry of the soil.
Right, and the chemistry right. of the soil.
Yep.
And so this is a little bit different context, but some of the work that I've done and that I've seen with bioretention cells, so from an urban stormwater management perspective, we see that. And some of it, and basically there will be phosphorus leaving the bioretention cell if the water coming in is low concentration phosphorus. So basically if you have a low amount of phosphorus coming in, then it's going to pick up whatever's in the soil and then leave with that phosphorus. If you have a high concentration of phosphorus coming in, then it's higher than what's in the soil or in the media. Sometimes it's an engineered media. And so it'll actually put phosphorus from the water into that media. And so it's hard to kind of, again, manage inputs. And this is either in an ag field or in an urban stormwater perspective. And then, so you have the input concentration, you have what's in the soil, and like you said, the chemical characteristic, chemical makeup of the soil, and then how much phosphorus is already there. And then, like Chad says, it can vary even within an event to go from very low to very high. So, yeah, so those three things, really the low concentration compared to nitrate.
Right.
That's a challenge, both from an education perspective as well as
monitoring.
Monitoring, right. And yep. Then when we get down to the analysis, like when we're analyzing for this stuff, the lower it goes, the harder it is to accurately measure.
Correct.
So then there's error there. Anyway, that's another.
Sampling error. It right. just makes it more difficult.
Makes it more difficult. So low concentrations, once it's in the system, it just cycles. And then the variability of it and kind of the dependence on all these different factors. So it's a challenging beast. I'm glad Lindsay is excited and ready to take on the challenge. It's great to have those folks in the region and kind of in the scientific field working on these very challenging, wicked problems, as we call them sometimes. But
grand challenges.
Grand challenge. Yeah, well, let's call it a grand challenge. So I think that's a great place to stop for now. We kind of covered the basics around phosphorus and then, you know, started with that really kind of scary story about the Toledo water crisis. And then next week, we're going to bring Chad in to talk about kind of what he has seen as the increase in phosphorus loss and phosphorus loading. And we'll get into your question or your response about manure, and I think we're going to have a really great discussion about manure and phosphorus. We'll also have two more episodes after that on phosphorus removal structures and treatment and kind of what the future looks like. But for now, as always, thank you for joining us on Streamlines, your source of water knowledge. And again, if you'd like to learn more about phosphorus and its effects on water quality, find us on the SDSU Extension website or follow me on Twitter at SDSUEXT Waterman. For now, I'm John McMain.
And I'm Anthony Bly.
And we'll talk again soon.